The Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
Opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium. News. My name is Scotty Reed. I'm broadcasting from behind the enemy lines of USA Inc. Today is June 7, 2016. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Very hot day here in the state of North Carolina. We've been getting a little bit of stormy weather overnight, but I do understand that it is hurricane season for people in certain parts of the country. Hope that our friends down in the Florida area is safe and sound, as I've been seeing news reports about inclement weather down there as well. We certainly know our people got hit hard by the storms in Houston, Texas. A lot of flooding and stuff going on. So this is hurricane season, as they call it. And so we just hope that nobody is affected by it that's in our listening audience. All right, today's program, we do have a guest for you today, Joseph R. Gibson, who is a education specialist and a author, will be coming on to discuss his recent book, How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain, Neuroplasticity and the Chronic Stress of Everyday Racism in Contemporary America. Very interesting subject matter. The book, I've been reading it. I haven't completed my reading, but I understand enough about it that certainly we can do an informed interview with Mr. Gibson when he joins us here in just about 7 minutes. I think he will be with us about 20 minutes, no longer than 30 minutes. So if you have any questions or comments that you would like to get into him, make sure you get those in early. Let me go ahead and give out the phone numbers for those who may not be on blacktalkradionetwork.com and listening through alternative means. The conference line number, of course, is 641-715-3660. The participant code is 549-032-POUND. Hit *6 and 1, and that will signal me, and I'll bring you on air. You can also give us a call on the studio line, and the studio line is for questions only. It's not, you know, for those who want to listen through the phone. That's what the conference line is for. But the studio line is strictly for questions. That's 704-951-5030. Again, that's 704-951-5030. So as I stated, looking forward to speaking to Mr. Gibson today. I kind of feel like the importance of this book and all the information that's in this book, we are definitely going to have him back on for a part two. I'm going to go ahead and start and say that already. But his book kind of falls in line with some of the stuff, topics that we have been covering on this program. I believe it was last week we took a look at the study that says that black people's genes, one particular gene that is related to stress, has mutated, is seen as being mutated in black folks. And they link this to slavery and saying it's hereditary and all this. And I kind of disagree with that. Now, they didn't come out and say, without a doubt, we found this evidence and this is what it is. But they did say that, you know, based on this evidence, we believe this may be the case. So it is not a definitive conclusion that black people's DNA has been changed by slavery. And then again, if we're talking about stress, black people have been undergoing stress for hundreds of years on this continent, related to racism and the system of slavery, all the way to today, you know. And so I'm kind of skeptical about saying, you know, stress-related genes have mutated in black people due to slavery, when, hell, slavery ain't never been abolished. And we're still living under white terrorism in this country. And yes, they do have proxy racist non-white tools working with them to abuse us. All right, so definitely want to talk to him. I learned some things already. I mistakenly thought that the human brain stops developing once a person turns 26 years old. Now I got a better understanding of that, meaning the physical attributes of your brain stops developing. It doesn't keep growing and growing and growing. It wouldn't be able to fit into your skull. You know, apparently your brain, the way that it functions, does change based on a number of external factors. And, you know, not talking about diseases or anything like that. We know diseases can affect the brain, but no, we're talking about external stimuli, external influence and what have you. So very interesting book. You can get it on Amazon, so I have linked to it, so definitely you might want to check it out. It's a good read. I've been reading it, and it's a good read thus far. But I, you know, again, I'm learning stuff about how people's brains work, how the human brains work, and just how little we know. And I'm talking about the masses, how we are impacted by external stimuli and what have you. After we speak with our guest today, Mr. Gibson, definitely want to go over some of the news of the day. A couple of stories that I'm looking at right now is a report that came out that said chronic cannabis use. Of course, they use the word marijuana. I don't use that word. Chronic cannabis use is about as bad for your health as not flossing, researchers find. So after all of these decades since they started criminalizing cannabis and whatnot, we've been hearing from the so-called scientific community about how dangerous cannabis is. It'll make you schizophrenic and all this and that. And there has been a lot of study and medical research done, scientific research done on cannabis, and it the benefits far outweigh any negatives. And according to this particular recent study, the negative is about the equivalent of not flossing your teeth. So bad breath and all that kind of stuff, you know, that if long-term cannabis use could lead to you, you know, having bad teeth and bad breath and all of that. But, you know, it doesn't say anything about schizophrenia. It doesn't say anything about reefer madness. Okay, I do believe we have our guest joining us on the line. Let me see if I can get this line open. Give me just a second. Give me just a second. Okay, we got it open. Do we have Mr. Gibson on the line?
Yep, this is he.
Good to speak with you, Mr. Gibson.
How you doing, sir?
A very intriguing book that you have written. So I'm still not gotten to the end of it, but what I have read thus far is very enlightening to me. So thank you, you know, for the book, and I learned something new just from reading your book.
Great, thank you.
If you don't mind, sir, since this is your first time on Black Talk Radio News, can you just give people, you know, a little brief information about your background?
Well, I've been writing for almost 20 years. I started when I was an undergraduate at Miami State University. I'm a native of Louisiana. I spent 5 years in the military, and after that, I began my career in education. I'm currently still an educator. I've taught in Atlanta and Detroit for a little over 10 years now. And I have a wife and one son.
And this, you've written prior books to this, right?
Yeah.
Okay, what are some of those titles?
So I've written a book on looking at the history of God, and God being presented originally as a black female. That was when God was a black woman. That's one of my more popular titles. I've also written a book on looking at unconscious racism in the urban classroom. It's called The Monsters We Make. I've also written other books on education. I've written a book called, I basically did an updated version of How Europe Underdeveloped Africa by Walter Rodney, entitled How Europe and America Are Still Underdeveloped in Africa. So I looked at a lot of the neocolonialism that still occurs in Africa and the effects. I've written a book about the black female image and how it's been sexualized. That's butterflies and blackbirds and bumblebees. So I've written quite a few. I think right now I'm a little over 20 on various topics. Like I said, I've been writing for a very long time, and I work really hard at it. Looking at white supremacy in a lot of different avenues, a lot of different aspects of it in the African American experience.
Now, this particular book that we will be discussing today, How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain, Neuroplasticity and the Chronic Stress of Everyday Racism in Contemporary America. What was the inspiration for this book? Is this something that you have been looking at over time, or had you come across some studies or other researchers' work? What inspired you to write about this subject?
Well, one of the first books I ever read about black people specifically was Carter G. Woodson and the Miseducation of the Negro. And there's a very famous quote in there that basically talks about, if you can control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. That quote has always kind of stuck with me, and it always bothered me because I could see how true it was. And, you know, by studying other people, I realized that was still impacting us. Like,
right,
something has happened to our thought process that makes rebellion in particular not likely anytime soon. So I wanted to really look at how our brain develops and how ultimately it can encourage us to be passive, tolerant of being oppressed. And I didn't know anything about neuroplasticity. I had never heard of the concept. I just began a search. So I kind of, you know, played around with it, discovered neuroplasticity, realized that was the key. You know, really studied it for a long time, figured out how it applies to racism. I specifically looked at stress and racism-related stress, which is a well-researched topic, even though it's not super super popular. And I put that together with neuroplasticity and said, okay, I think I have something here, and just really developed it out. And like I said, I applied it to what's basically called conditioned docility, when you become conditioned to being passive and accepting of your oppressed state. So
Can you give us that Carter G. Woodson quote again?
I'm paraphrasing. But basically, if you control a man's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. Okay. I'll try to find the extended version so I can quote directly. But basically, in that quote, Mr. Woodson says that if you could, you basically create a situation where you don't have to worry about them.
Right.
Those people rebelling.
Right. You know, the reason I asked you to repeat that is because it resonates with me and from my studies on media. What got me to engage in what I'm engaging in right now through the Black Talk Media Project and this platform, Black Talk Radio Network, was Malcolm X saying that media is the most powerful entity on the face of the planet. It controls the minds of the masses, how it can make the innocent look guilty and the guilty look innocent, and that's power. And so I concluded that is how they control thoughts and actions, is through media programming. I mean, you know, you take the word programming, for those who are computer enthusiasts and whatnot, you know, you're programming that machine to complete certain tasks or complete certain functions and what have you. And so I apply that, you know, although I don't know if it's correct, or not, but we've often heard the human brain compared to a computer, and that you can, you know, program the human brain. I also read a couple of other studies over the past couple of weeks about propaganda. And propaganda, yes, being used as a tool to control people's thoughts, speech, and actions.
Right. Yeah, all goes together. I did find the quote. If you can control a man's thinking, you do not have to worry about his actions. When you determine what a man shall think, you do not have to concern yourself about what he will do. Mm. If you make a man feel that he is inferior, you do not have to compel him to accept an inferior status, for he will seek it himself. That's really, you know, that whole presumption of black inferiority is something that I really looked at a lot in this book. Mm-hmm. Just how it was developed over time and how we've internalized it both as black people and white people. Mm-hmm. And then the effects it has on changing our brain.
Okay. Hey, you seem to be fading out on us at other times. I don't know what you're using, but if you could speak directly into it, it'll help the listeners out a lot.
Okay.
You said that you had never heard the term neuroplasticity. And
right.
I had heard it before, but didn't pay it no mind. Didn't, you know, look it up or anything like that. But I looked it up, and, you know, I found the definition, and it corrected some information that I incorrectly interpreted. And, you know, I had come across some studies about the human brain stops developing when a human being reaches, in general, around the age of 26 years old. You know, and that is why, and we were looking at it from the standpoint of juvenile justice and how it's not right to sentence children as adults when their brains are not even capable of making fully informed decisions at times and things of that nature. But after I looked up neuroplasticity, you know, it isn't talking about the brain physically, you know, growing, but just how the brain functions. So if you could break it down for our listeners in layman terms, how you understand neuroplasticity.
Well, basically, any type of neural activity changes the brain structurally,
mm-hmm,
or functionally.
Okay.
So particularly if it's a repeated thing. So our thoughts, our observations, our feelings, our actions, our reactions, all of those things require neural activity.
Okay.
And if you can repeat that neural activity, that specific thing, often enough, it begins to make more and more changes in the structure or the function of various parts of the brain, mm-hmm, particularly if that activity is emotional or traumatic or, mm-hmm, stressful. Those types of neural activity have a huge impact on the structure and the functioning of key parts of our brain, particularly those parts of our brain that regulate emotion.
Now, let's jump into the book, and thank you for that explanation. Let's jump to the book. The first chapter, When a Spell is Put on You, an Introduction to the Survival-Oriented Human Brain and How Chronic Stress Changes It. So what did you rely on as research materials to substantiate how the human brain is being changed by stress?
Well, I looked at a lot of different scholarly sources. I really studied. I wanted to, basically in that first chapter, I was showing you what I learned about neuroplasticity.
Okay.
And I specifically was focusing on the survival orientation of the human brain. The human brain evolved as the primary organ that we have to guide us, to promote our own survival.
Okay.
So most of what we do is survival based. It's intended to promote our survival.
It's like instinct?
Yeah. Over time it becomes an instinct. So there are certain things that we learn, certain things that we feel, certain things that we observe and we remember, that all, if we repeat these things, they tend to promote our survival.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the human brain and most of the emotions that we express, all of these things are related to our survival. So the things that are more likely to cause us to survive, we tend to repeat.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that we repeat, the thoughts that we repeat, the emotions that we repeat, these all begin to change the structure and the functioning of our brain.
Thank you for that. Now, you know, in this chapter, you talk about responses to fear, the fear response, also known as the stress response, and the flight or flight response. Now, you did write this book with racism, white supremacy in mind, to help black people understand the system a little bit better and the things that we are facing. I also heard you on our network a couple of weeks ago on another program, and you talked about it was more likely, and you know, we're not talking about, of course there's exceptions to every rule, but in general the black response to white terrorism has been flight. Is that accurate?
Either flight or denial, which is another version of flight.
And is this learned? Is this programmed? How did this become the normal response to threatening situations or fear?
Well, basically, over time, if you specifically, and I specifically focused on the black experience in America. I didn't really go to Africa with this particular book.
Okay.
If you look historically, we learned what to be afraid of,
mm-hmm.
and how to react to white supremacy in ways that promoted our own individual survival. So because we repeated these thoughts and these actions and these emotions, over time they begin to change various functions and various structures of our brains. And based on the concept of epigenetics, we were primed, our brains were primed from generation to generation to react to white supremacy in certain ways. We were more likely to react in ways to white supremacy that allowed us to maintain our individual survival because of those brain changes. So as a result, basically we learned, or we became conditioned,
mm-hmm.
to be afraid of white supremacy and react to it in ways that were safe.
Mm-hmm. And when you say white supremacy, I take it that you mean racist white people responding,
right,
to them and whatnot.
Right.
And wouldn't it also be true to say that parents have also instilled this flight reaction in their children because they didn't want their children to suffer any kind of repercussions from being rebellious to racism, white supremacy?
Yes, sir. There are certain socializing agents that all human beings have that have a huge role in socialization, which is basically the changing of our brains to survive our social environment. and the parents are the primary agents of that. So we learned a lot of stuff. Our brains were shaped a lot by our parents' reactions and expectations for our reactions to racism.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if there's anything else before we move on to the next topic. Now, this is something that I've learned over the years, is that fear isn't necessarily a bad thing, because it can actually save your life or give you adrenaline to be able to physically deal with an immediate threat. And what have you. So fear isn't a necessary bad thing, but in the context of what we're talking about is a fear so much of white people, of white races, that we dare not rise up and overthrow the system in this country in particular. Because we've seen in other places, and not to say there weren't any rebellions here in the colonies or on this particular continent, but you know, and because of course the Haitian rebellion, you know, they certainly were not afraid of, at the time, the most powerful European army at the time, on I would say in the world at that time, the French, and how they stood up to them. So it's not necessary, fear is not necessarily a bad thing, but when we're talking about a socialized system, you know, I just don't see it benefits us to be afraid of this system.
Right. It's more of an anxiety. It's more of an anticipation of consequences for rebellion.
Okay.
I actually wrote a book a while back called Black Spartacus, where I looked at some of the key characteristics of the numerous black-on-white rebellions in history.
Okay.
And what really motivated them, what sustained these rebellions that we often don't talk about. So you're right. We're not always cowards when it comes to racism. Oftentimes we fought, but now we have more of a conditioned anxiety where we anticipate a negative retaliation if we do anything that looks like we're not accepting our inferior status.
Okay. Let's move on to the next chapter. Wish We Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free, an introduction to racism-related neuroplasticity and the chronic stress of everyday racism. What do you mean, we wish we knew what it would feel like to be free? Are we not experiencing freedom right now?
I don't believe so. Not in the definition of freedom that I subscribe to.
Okay.
Which I learned from Assata Shakur a while back. Basically, you know, to be able to be who we want to be. I feel like a lot of the black self concept is stereotype based and imposed upon us, so we're not really oftentimes free to even know who we are for real.
Mm-hmm.
Or we're not free enough to be who we should be. Most of the times we are just a reaction to stereotypes.
Wow.
And we live our lives based on other people's expectations for us.
So in other words, we believed all the bad things or the propaganda that they put out about us being inferior. Are you saying that some of us have come to believe in our inferiority?
I would say the majority, based on
the majority
what you can observe.
Okay. Would you say that majority was 60%, 70%, if you can put a number on it?
I'm in education, as I mentioned earlier.
Yes,
you know,
sir.
I teach mostly black kids from high poverty backgrounds.
Okay.
You know, like I said, Detroit and in Atlanta. I see the evolution of our acceptance of our own inferiority on a daily basis. It's a very unfortunate thing to see, but that's what I fight on a daily basis. So if I had to come, and then if you look at the news, and I know the news is biased,
right,
but if you just kind of take a minute and look around you in areas that are predominantly African American, you see a lot of negative things. You see a lot of us acting out what would basically be called stereotypic behavior. That's probably happened over. We have really intelligent, hardworking, anti-stereotype black people, but they are the minority. I would probably say somewhere near 25%. It's an unfortunate thing to admit to, But by and large, we express a lot of negative traits.
I would have to agree with you on that. Let me see. Now, you also in this chapter, you also mentioned that both whites and blacks are impacted by this. How are whites impacted with what? A false sense of superiority or what?
Yeah, the book talks about the delusion of white superiority.
Okay.
Where it's hard for them to constantly maintain this delusion. And there's always an anxiety, oftentimes it's subconscious, but there's this underlying anxiety with white people to maintain their delusion of superiority, particularly around black people. So that's a stressful thing for them. And they have to do it every day. Every time they're encountering black people, they have to maintain their superiority. So basically, you're living a lie. You have to convince other people that that lie is the truth. And if there's any time where you slip up, there's always that fear of, what if they see through our alleged inferiority? And then that becomes a source of stress. Mm-hmm. There's also that underlying historical, omnipresent fear of black retaliation to the privileges that white people get because of racism.
Right.
I think, you know, historically and now, not so much now because of our conditioned docility, but there's always that underlying fear or anticipation that we'll rise up. We'll rebel, we'll fight, we'll kill if we have to produce the end of racism and the end of, you know, white superiority, white privilege, and black inferiority.
Now,
that becomes a source of stress.
Now, in your book, you also mention scientific racism and how, you know, that plays into the thought processes of wannabe white supremacists and whatnot. So institutionally, you know, just like we're being portrayed as being inferior, you know, institutionally, these things are supporting the myth of white supremacy, right?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, historically, the whole concept of looking at the brain was part of initially, as it applies to race anyway, was initially part of scientific racism. The goal was to convince society that the black brain was fundamentally different from the white brain, but in ways that produced inferiority amongst black people. So they started to falsely study the brain and make these claims that there were these differences in the black brain versus the white brain, and those differences were a mark of inferiority.
Now, before I move to the next couple of questions on the next chapter, before we close out this particular topic, could you give us your definition of freedom? What would freedom look like for you?
Basically, to not be burdened by black inferiority, that presumed black inferiority, to not have to worry about, not have to be stigmatized and not have to worry about the stigma of blackness in America, to just wake up and be a fully recognized human being,
right,
and not my skin color be the determining factor on expectations for my life, opportunities that I actually get,
right.
I'm not necessarily looking for equality because, who are they to be equal to? But I am looking for a chance to be free of the stigma of presumed black inferiority. I think that's freedom.
Gotcha. Now, next chapter, why blackbirds don't try to fly. And we've touched upon this, a little bit, but it says racism-related neuroplasticity and conditioned docility among contemporary African Americans. And so, docile, saying, when you say docile, Okay, because we do see, let's say, for example, we have always seen a bunch of people marching, a bunch of people, you know, having rallies and stuff and you know, trying to address these issues. Would you call that being docile or you know, how would you frame it?
I wouldn't disrespect that by calling it docile.
Okay. Because they're doing something, right?
Right, they're doing something.
Right, right. So, you know, to me, when I think about it, I think about not so much that they made us docile, but they made us Americans. They made us think that we are Americans too, and you know, that we should support America and everything that it does all across the world, even if it's acts of injustice and whatnot. This was really on display when the Obama administration attacked Libya, and I'm seeing all these black people being murdered by these Arab Islamists, being supported by NATO. And the reaction of black people was like, you know, like America was right. I just couldn't quite understand that. I don't know if that's being docile or that's just being sold out.
Yeah, that might be brainwashed too.
Brainwashed, okay.
Or just, you know, integrating into the, you know, assimilating. You know, a lot of us strive to become American, like ultra American, because we believe that it'll hide our blackness,
mm-hmm.
which is frowned upon, that we look at as a negative thing. Mm-hmm. So if we can't become white American, we become, you know, super American. Anything to remove the African part, anything to remove the black part.
Right, right. Now, on the docile issue, though, I have noticed, though, how black folks in general is quick to condemn a black person who uses an act of violence against his oppressor.
Yep.
And I think that's programmed as well. You know, I'm 50. I was born in 1966. And I can just recall ever since I became, you know, really paying attention to my surroundings, that has been the program. That, not to say anything about Dr. King, negative about Dr. King, because I understood that his nonviolence was a strategy, was a tactic, and I know the reason that he did that. But that is now being promoted to us by the system of white supremacy. This is the appropriate response to mistreatment, to nonviolently, you know, give your grievances and whatnot. And that's, you don't even see that in the natural world. When an animal right. is attacked, what is that animal going to do? It's going to do either one or two things, which you know, discussed in earlier chapters, fight or flight. And so we're being programmed to be docile, and it's just crazy, man. It's just crazy. So do you have any further thoughts on that? How you know, we're being programmed to be so passive and docile?
Well, again, that's really a key theme in this particular book.
Mm-hmm.
Ever since Matt Turner in those days, the goal has been to limit and eventually suppress altogether black rebellion, particularly violent black rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
So every time someone, a black leader, you know, was created and began to promote the idea that the only way this system of racism is going to change is through by some type of violence against racism and racists, that person was neutralized.
Mm-hmm.
Either they were assassinated, imprisoned, discredited, something like that, and we learned that reaction. And that reaction, or those consequences, became so consistent that we learned that, hey, basically, I've always remembered this quote from Dr. Wilson, where she talked about how young black people learn that if you help black people, you will be killed. And we've seen that repeatedly throughout our history, that the people who really help black people to the point of violently opposing white supremacy and mm-hmm. racism, they were killed. They were in prison.
Right.
So it really created that condition. It began to nurture that conditioned docility amongst us. Because, again, the brain changes in ways that promote the individual's survival.
Mm-hmm.
So we learned that, you know, if you don't rebel, then you're more likely to survive.
Nothing about quality of life, just survival. Right.
Just length of life. Length of life is more important.
Now, on that subject, though, maybe you can shine some light onto this, but I often notice the contradictory statements of people who will be quick to condemn a black person who uses counter violence against a violent system, but these same people are not quick to call out the violence of, let's say, the United States government through its military and going around destroying non-white countries and taking away their rights to self-determination, basically taking their freedom away. But, you know, and I'm like, well, it just puzzles me. It puzzles me. You want us to be non-violent, but you cheered when Bin Laden was killed. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
You got any thoughts on that contradicting thinking?
Well, first off, I agree. But then you also have to understand the process of demonization.
Okay.
Like, and I'm not saying you don't, but certain people are demonized in the American media and through the American education system. So those people become seen, looked at as enemies by most Americans, because that's what America wants us to look at. So it's easier for us to accept the killing of an evil person, someone who we've been made to look at as a monster, someone who's worthy of dying. That's why we would celebrate those types of things, like the killing of Osama bin Laden or Gaddafi or somebody like that,
right,
who, if you really understand their history and what they've actually done, are not monsters, who have actually done a lot of positive things when it comes to black self-determination or non-white self-determination. But in America, the media and the education system, we're kind of fed, we're conditioned to accept who's the bad guys, who's the not bad guys. Even when you look at African history, and when it came to neo-colonialism, you know, we were fed to accept certain African leaders and to look at other African leaders as evil and monsters.
Right.
But when you look at the history, the people that were supported by America were actually the people killing other Africans and exploiting and they were greedy and taking all the money. So it's been a long history of that person's the enemy, so they should be your enemy too, and then we buy into it.
Again, we are speaking with author educator Joseph R. Gibson. He's the author of the book How Racism Has Changed the Human Brain, Neuroplasticity and the Chronic Stress of Everyday Racism in Contemporary America. I see we got some people on the line. If you would like to ask a question or comment before we close it out with him, please hit *6 and 1. You can ask your question or comment, or you can hit us up on the studio line, 704-951-5030. I want to jump to the last chapter, because this kind of is something that I've been studying too, which I imagine a whole lot of people been studying or should be studying, on how to end, you know, this system of injustice, this system of racism that promotes the myth, the false myth of white supremacy. But the name of the chapter is Why It's Still Gonna Rain Today: How Neuroplasticity and Practicing Mindfulness Could End Everyday Racism, but Probably Won't. What do you call practicing mindfulness?
Well, basically, it's a Buddhist concept that says you focus your mind, you meditate on the here and now, and you focus on what you can control right now.
Okay.
Whether it be your emotions, whether it be your reactions, whether it be your thought process, you really focus on now instead of fearing the future and, you know, being angry or afraid of the past. You focus on right now, what you can control, and how you could more constructively react to the present.
Got you. Now, you say, you know, it could end everyday racism, but you're skeptical. Why do you say, you know, it probably won't end it?
Because white people benefit and are primarily responsible for everyday racism.
Okay.
They have no collective benefit of ending racism, because they, the privilege, white privilege, is based off of black disadvantage. Right. Black disadvantage is justified under racism and the presumption of black inferiority. Mm-hmm. So I don't see white people deciding one day to all of a sudden end racism, mm-hmm. and end the advantages and the privileges they get as a result of it. So, you know, to hope for that to happen is somewhat foolhardy.
Okay. Now, on a global scale, looking at the system, as Neely Fuller calls it, a global system of white supremacy, I tend to call it slavery, because I see white supremacy as a symptom of slavery, because the white supremacist codes, you know, when first white privilege was first introduced in this country, it was introduced in the Virginia colony in the slave codes, and when it started stripping blacks of their rights, black colonists and what have you. And but I have thought about this. I have theorized that we could end white supremacy globally if non-white people would stop assisting these racist whites. You got any thoughts on that?
I agree, but I don't see that happening anytime soon because of the theme of this book, because of the right. fact that our brains have been changed to support white supremacy out of fear of it. So if that happened, yeah. I mean, because, I mean, even if you go back to the beginnings of slavery, you know, and Roots just came on the other day, and I'm sure a lot of people saw it, you know, maybe not for the first time, but slavery wouldn't have been possible without support. Mm-hmm. White supremacy today is, and white privilege exists today because we allow it to.
Mm-hmm.
We allow it to. So, mm-hmm. yeah, as soon as we stop giving our support to it, things will change. Mm-hmm. But the likelihood of that happening is somewhat low, unfortunately, because of our brain adjusting to these realities and being afraid to do anything different.
Right, got you. Let me give a small example of that. Like, let's use a work related. So this black employee co-worker that I had, I had a supervisor's position. I was, like, you know, coming up with formulas for particular colors used in dyes, and I was doing it on a computer programming and you know, looking at past dyings and seeing what went wrong. We need to add a little bit more of this. So anyway, you know, I would come in and the folders of what we were working on would be missing. I would spend like maybe 2 hours looking for these folders. I'm running the third shift, didn't want to call the section supervisor over that department because he's at home in the bed. Who wants to be, you know, woken up at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know, because Scotty can't find the work that he's supposed to be doing? And so I didn't say nothing to him or whatnot. And then this black coworker told me that he had seen the other guy who had the similar position that I had, but he was on the second shift, this white person, and he was hiding the folder. Said he saw him hiding the folders and whatnot. And I was like, wow, man. I was like, so you saw him, right? He was like, yeah. So will you go with me to my boss and you know, tell him what you just told me? I ain't got nothing to do with it, man. I just thought I'd tell you and let you handle it. But, you know, I my name is Bennett and I ain't in it. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, because he was afraid of snitching, I guess, on this white supremacist, even though he see this racist white supremacist wannabe, you know, mistreating me and sabotaging me. But he was too concerned, too fearful for losing his own position. Is that a good example?
That is a great example. I mean, because of that conditioned hostility, we're pretty much left with, as individuals, we try to be to get as much benefit, socioeconomic benefit, as we can. We are striving for exceptionalism when it comes to not being limited socially and economically. We want to be looked at as individuals, and we don't want to risk that. So okay. We'll do whatever we can to basically be co-opted by white supremacy. But we don't want to be looked at as rebels, because we don't want to risk whatever chances we get as individuals individual privilege.
Do you have, Mr. Gibson, do you have any suggestions to parents, to young people, to anyone who wants to change their thought processes and not letting fear, that emotion, fear, run them and rule their lives and what have you? How is there anything that you would suggest to us to how we can make sure our children don't come up with this problem?
Right. Well, the conclusion of this book focuses on two things. One is to practice mindfulness meditation, where you basically study how you've been reacting to racism, how you've been reacting to your presumed inferiority, in order to understand it and then to better control it.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes some time, months maybe, to really calm down and look at what you've internalized as far as your reactions and particularly your emotional and your consistent reactions to racism, so you can identify how you can change. Why do you need to change? I believe that's the first step.
Right.
Another key step is to study Black history. And I'm not talking about the limited Black history that we tend to get during Black History Month,
mm-hmm.
but I mean like a thorough, comprehensive study of Black history, particularly looking at Black rebels.
Right.
Violent Black rebellions against white supremacy in any form. So I'm talking about studying, all the way Nat Turner, looking at D'Don Kamadi, really looking at how courageous Black people have been historically, looking at a
Sada Shakur.
Right. Yeah. It's a lot of people that we just don't learn about because, as you mentioned earlier, we tend to be fed the safe integration Black people. We don't get the violent nationalist Black people. But if you study those people, it'll build up your courage and your self-respect, and it'll take away a lot of that internalized Black inferiority, and it'll allow you to heal and to react better to racism.
Well, Mr. Gibson, I definitely want to thank you for spending time with us today. I'm going to continue to read the book, but I certainly want to bring you back on at a future date to continue this discussion. And thank you again, man, because I'm learning, I learned some things about neuroplasticity from reading this book. And it also confirmed some things that I had already, believed. And it's good to see those confirmed by, another intelligent Black man who's seeing the same thing. So thank you so much for this book. How can people get the book? How can they follow your work? Do you got a website or anything like that?
Yes, sir. We have KitabuPublishing.com. That's KITABU Publishing.com. We also have the Kitabu Publishing Company Facebook page. So you can find us on Facebook at Kitabu Publishing Company. And the web page has links to all of the books. We sell through Amazon. We also sell through Barnes & Noble. And on those sites, you'll see descriptions of the books. We look at a lot of different aspects of the Black experience, so you'll find something, you might find a whole bunch of titles that you find particularly interesting. So again, I just want to say thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I look forward to speaking with you again soon.
Is there anything in closing you would like to leave with the listeners?
There's a line. I studied Dr. Frances Cross Wilson for a long time, and I'm saddened by her passing. And one of the things that always stuck out with me with her is how we try to, as Black people, we deny the reality of racism because we're afraid. We deny the fact that there's a war still going on to maintain racism. I just say, every day do something to build up your courage. Do something every day to understand better racism so that you can find creative ways and strategies to fight it, because that's the only way this is going to end. It's going to be a fight.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you again, Mr. Gibson, and you have a blessed and productive day, sir.
You too. Thank you again.
You're welcome. All right, that concludes our interview with Mr. Gibson. Please check out this book. Very enlightening, very intriguing. You definitely will learn something, how racism has changed the human brain, neuroplasticity, and the chronic stress of everyday racism in contemporary America. I was kind of in the flow there. I forgot to take my station identification breaks at the half hour mark. I tend to do that when I'm hosting and engineering at the same time. I forget things, so I need to take a station identification break. When I come back, I do want to share two news stories with you. I want to talk about this research about chronic cannabis use is about as bad for your health as not flossing. Researchers find. And the reason I think this is important study, not that I needed this study to tell me this, but because there have been other studies, but this is a new one, all right, is that it undercuts the whole argument, or it undercuts the criminal justice policy that is outlawing cannabis. All right. So definitely want to look at that, because, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there about cannabis. People who use cannabis are demonized as all being a bunch of potheads and dope heads, and their minds ain't working right, and they're suffering from all these mental illnesses because they smoking weed, and nothing could be further from the truth. So want to talk about that. Also, you may have seen this story, but I didn't come across it until today. But there was a CNN is reporting that last Thursday there was a black man who was found hung in a tree, and he had been missing since earlier this month. And so let me look at the date on this. When they say earlier,
everybody wants answers and they want those quickly. We understand that.
Okay, hold up there. I wasn't ready to play you. Okay. Okay, my bad. I came across this today, but this is an old story. I actually remember this story. Okay, so yeah, we're not going to talk about that one. This is actually a couple of years old. So I didn't see the date on it. I just saw it come across my social media timeline. I was like, Lord, not another one. They didn't got another one. So anyway, we'll be back on the other side. Take this station identification break, kick some God Life beats from Sincere Naquari, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. If you have any thoughts, comments about our conversation with our guests, feel free to call in and share. We'll be back on the other side.
The Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium.
You are tuned in to Black Talk Radio, new black media for the new millennium.
Wave your hands in the air, and wave them like you just don't care. If the party's hype and you're feeling nice to you, yeah, oh, yeah. Wave your hands in the air. Wave them like you just don't care. If the party's hype and you're feeling nice, oh yeah. We'll be right back.
waving like you just don't care. If a party's hype and you're feeling nice, say, oh yeah, oh yeah.
And welcome back to Black Talk Radio News. Those are some God Life beats from the artist Sincere Nokwari, the Beat Tape Lectures Volume 1. Just do a Google search on Sincere Nokwari or God Life Beats. That'll take you to his website. All right. Okay. Now, let me say this before I jump into this study about long-term cannabis use not being as bad for your health as all these people been telling you for decades and what have you, so they could justify fining you, jailing you, and putting you in prison for using a plant that grows wild, that's natural. You don't even have to do nothing to it, add nothing to it, or anything. And the medicinal benefits have long been known by the ancestors and what have you. You know, they even found cannabis in some of the tombs in Egypt. That's how long people been using, you know, what the Creator has given us. All right. So we ain't talking about smoking crack. We ain't talking about shooting heroin. No, we ain't talking about nothing like that. We're talking about a plant called cannabis. All right. So, but before I get to that, you know, going back to our interview, in our discussion with Mr. Gibson, we had a caller, our caller who sometimes called in from New Jersey, and we talked about this, something similar along these lines. And she was just, you know, I mentioned how my mother had raised me. I had mentioned, you know, my uncles and my aunts and my relatives in this area deep behind enemy lines in North Carolina, them coming up in a state that had the largest number of due paying members of the Ku Klux Klan and terrorizing, you know, and so I wasn't raised to be afraid of these people. I was not raised that way. You know, they tried to burn a cross. Well, they did burn a cross, came in the middle of the night, burned a cross in my grandfather's property at the house. My uncles woke up. It was like, it was 11 children in all. Three of them was girls. So about eight boys. Yeah, eight boys. You know, the they all had kept guns in the house. That's one of the things I noticed when I came back down here from Detroit and visited with my grandfather when he was still alive. There seemed to be a shotgun or a rifle in every corner of the freaking house. All right. And that was in many black households. I've read books like, you know, what is that? By the dude from North Carolina, Robert F. Williams, Negroes and Guns. You know, they describe similar stuff about that's just, you know, the way blacks in the South, we always, you know, stayed armed and whatnot. The Black Guard, you ever heard of them? You know, certainly were not afraid, certainly did not believe in white supremacy and black inferiority or anything like that, as they actually got into gun battles. My uncles got into gun battles that night. They burned the cross in the yard. And my uncles came out with their guns blazing, and they took off like the cowards that they are. You know, when they started integrating schools down here, my aunt used to tell me how her brothers would, you know, and other people at the school would be battling them racist crackers down here and whatnot. And so even when we moved to Detroit and I got ripped out of my all black school and, you know, bussed across to a predominantly white school, my mom told me, you know, don't let them ever put their hands on you. You know, if you do something wrong, they got my number. They can call me. Because, you know, capital punishment was a big thing back then. She was like, no, you do not let them put their hands on you. You tell them they better call your mama and whatnot. So I was not raised with a fear of these people and whatnot. Then when I came back down here for junior high and high school and whatnot, and, you know, not to be, you know, bragging or anything like that. That's not why I'm saying this. But when I saw that, you know, my grades were just as good or better than 95% of this predominantly white school I was going to, I never saw or believed anything was superior about them. You know, I scored the second highest on the SAT in this predominantly white school, 80% white. This one white girl, she did score higher than me. I had the second highest score. So I just never believed in white supremacy, the white supremacy of white people and whatnot. You know, I live in a rural area, lots of poor white people around here living way worse than what I'm living. Not that I'm, you know, in a bad situation or anything like that. So, you know, it does. I think our parents do play a huge role in molding our minds and shielding us from the harmful impact of the promotion of, you know, the inferiority of black people. So mom, dad, uncles, aunts, grandfather, grandmother, thank you. Thank you for instilling that in me. All right, so moving on. This report came out. This is a article that was published in the Washington Post by Christopher Ingram on June the 2nd. So, you know, just about a week ago, 5 days ago. And, you know, I don't use the M word, so I'm going to replace it with the scientific word, cannabis. I call it weed sometimes, too. But long-term cannabis use is not associated with a raft of physical health problems, according to a new study, with one surprising exception: gum disease. Researchers led by Madeline H. Meir of Arizona State University tracked the cannabis habits of over 1,037 New Zealanders from birth to middle age to see what effect these habits have on some common measures of physical health, including lung function, systemic inflammation, cholesterol levels, blood pressure, body weight, blood sugar, and dental health. What they found was surprising. After controlling for other factors known to affect health, especially tobacco use and socioeconomic status because of that stress related to being poor, cannabis use had no negative effect on any measure of health except for dental health. People who smoke more weed had a higher incidence of gum disease. So stop smoking it. Put it in the brownies. Make some cannabis smoothies and what have you. You don't have to consume it by smoking it, where you're taking in carcinogens from the paper that you're rolling it up in and what have you. So you don't have to smoke it. But that's all they found. That's all they found was that there was a link to gum disease, bad breath, and all of that kind of stuff in long-term cannabis users. Right? They didn't have higher instances of mental health problems. They, you know, wasn't crazy, didn't become schizophrenic, hallucinating, and whatnot. And that just reminds me, this black man in Charlotte, religious man. His daughter had on a T-shirt with the devil on it or something, a picture of Satan or something. They didn't really show the shirt and make it clear. So he became upset. He took his daughter's shirt and burnt it up. Then, to atone for her sins, he was going to sacrifice one of his children, citing the Bible. You know, when which one of those characters it was that was going to sacrifice his only son and whatnot, you know, human sacrifice. So he was going to sacrifice his daughter and whatnot. No, his son. Boy was like only 6 years old or something like that. Then he said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to sacrifice the dog. All right, they had a little poodle and whatnot. So he strangles the dog, chokes it out with his hand, kills it, breaks its neck, then puts it in his barbecue smoker and lights it on fire. By that point, his family had fled the home and, you know, had called the police on them and what have you. They were fearing for their lives. So when the cops get there and whatnot, this dude want to blame it. Oh, I smoked some weed this morning. As if smoking weed made him commit animal sacrifice. Perhaps believing, perhaps your religious delusions is what caused you to act in such a manner. It ain't have nothing to do with cannabis. But it just kills me that whenever people get busted doing something wrong or something like that, they always want to blame it on something else. Yeah, the weed made me do it. Or the alcohol, blame it on the alcohol or something like that. Nothing but excuses. But again, getting back to this study, says that in general, our findings show that cannabis use, finally they use the word cannabis instead of the racist M word, use over 20 years was unrelated to health problems in early midlife. The study published in the journal JAMA Psychiatry found. So this is a psychiatric study as well. So again, I'm sure they were looking for mental illnesses. I mean, still, that's physical, your brain and what have you. But yet, I've heard psychiatrists in the past talking about black people smoking weed ain't going to be doing nothing but sitting around in a daze, not looking for work or something like that. You know, repeating them, reefer madness. And I know where it came from. It came from white people who wanted to demonize Mexicans, to criminalize cannabis, and also criminalize black jazz musicians, because, you know, these white women going to these jazz clubs and smoking weed, and it's lowering their inhibitions, and they're having sex with Negroes, and what, we got to ban the cannabis and what have you. So I know where these stereotypes and this misinformation come from. Look on YouTube, look up the documentary they did, I think it was in the 1930s, could have been in the 40s, called Reefer Madness. And people still running around repeating this crazy stuff to this day. Well, here's another study that disputes all of that propaganda. All right. So this undercuts every argument that has been made that we need to criminalize cannabis to protect people from themselves, and, you know, because it causes them to commit crime and makes them lazy and blah, 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 bunch of bull. So, they, you know, President Obama right now could remove cannabis from the DEA's scheduled list of the world's most dangerous drugs and what have you, that have no medicinal value and they're just dangerous and what have you. And Obama himself has said that he believed that weed was no more dangerous than alcohol. He should know. He was in the Chum gang when he was in Hawaii. He did he smoked plenty of weed, and they got some good weed in Hawaii too. And you know, he smoked it along with some other drugs in college and all that. So he know it wasn't no more dangerous than alcohol. And study after study continues to show that alcohol is far more dangerous than cannabis. Again, the only thing they found over this 20-year study was that smoking it contributes to gum disease. So why isn't the CEO of USA Inc., why is he refusing to remove it from the scheduled list of most dangerous drugs? Why does he want the federal government to continue to criminalize it when it's not logical? So it's just not logical. The science proves it's not logical. What did he say when he was asked to remove it, which is well within his power as CEO of the executive branch of the U.S. government? All he got to do is issue an order and it's done. But no, he's saying, oh, if y'all want it removed, get Congress to push a bill through. Well, sir, wait a minute. You got the power to where you don't have to go through Congress. Why you want to go through Congress? And when you know Congress is don't always want to block everything you trying to do that's supposed to be good for people and what have you, why would you ask for a bill to come through Congress and waste all this money and time when you could just simply, in an act of justice, remove it? He needs to give a good explanation, tell me that Congress needs to pass a bill when I know how the government works, and he has that power as the executive officer, chief executive officer. What's going on with him? Could it be that he does not want to do anything to harm the system of slavery? Because that is the number one most used, if you want to call it a drug, I call it a herb. But this is the most used herb on the face of the planet. Not heroin, not crack, not powder, cocaine, not any of that other stuff. Cannabis is. And that is how they are arresting a whole lot of people, fining a whole lot of people, and putting people in jail and prison behind cannabis. That, you know, going back to our interview about what it means to be free, you certainly ain't free if a government can tell you you can't grow a plant and make use of that plant. What kind of freedom is that? That ain't freedom. They're telling you what you can and cannot put into your body and telling lies, talking about how harmful it is to you, when the facts show it's not that harmful. It's more helpful. Treats a whole bunch of ailments and whatnot. All the medical studies have been done. So here's another one. This is just the latest one. So, you know, I prefer to stick to the facts instead of conjecture and this mythology and you know, stereotyping people who use cannabis and whatnot, inciting, you know, these things that are just not correct. All right, so that's all I got for you today. Again, today is Tuesday. Normally, Tando Radio Show comes on at 6 o'clock, but Dave is shooting a seminar, video shooting a seminar, so he will not be on air today. Also, we thought that Dark Matter Radio will debut tonight, but it will not debut tonight. It won't debut to next Monday at 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern time. We got a brother from Canada who will be hosting that program, Dark Matter. So I just wanted to get those updates before I closed out. But yeah. All right. So recognize the fact that you do live behind enemy lines. It's a battlefield out there, and that you should be conducting yourself in a way that doesn't put a target on your back, that doesn't make it easy for these slave catchers to snatch you up. All right. Now, I'm not talking about walking around and being fearful of these people. No, I'm talking about just recognizing the realities on the battlefield, and that they ain't never stopped practicing slavery. And so you can't help us end slavery if you are enslaved on the prison plantation. Well, you know, I take that back. We got some freedom fighters on the plantation right now fighting, you know, having work stoppages and educating the public and whatnot about how they're being mistreated, abused, and exploited, their labor being exploited and whatnot. So I take that back. But nobody wants to be on a prison plantation, so don't make it easy for them. That's all I'm saying. Not saying be in fear for them. I'm just saying utilize common sense. Don't attract attention to yourself when you're moving behind these enemy lines. All right, so until, let me see, Wednesday, I will be on air with an episode of New Abolitionist Radio. Myself, Max Johannin, every Wednesday, New Abolitionist Radio, 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern time, where we discuss the system of modern-day slavery and human trafficking. All right, y'all be safe out there. Peace and blessings to all.